Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. He'll be back tomorrow, don't fear. And I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Todd.
Well, we've been talking all morning, and we'll continue talking about this data dump by WikiLeaks, a 250,000 confidential American diplomatic cables on the internet and obtained by the New York Times and posted on the net in varying degrees. We're expecting them to leak out as the days go on. The documents were shared with media outlets, including the Times, and all over the press this morning. They provide an unprecedented look at the role of American diplomats around the world. According to the confidential cables, State Department personnel have been ordered basically to spy on their former counterparts. Joining us this morning is Andy Laron, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Also on the line is Ronald E. Newman, a member of the diplomatic community, former American ambassador to Afghanistan, Algeria, and Bahrain. Ambassador, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Andy, start us off here. What kind of information has the State Department been telling its personnel to collect on other foreign officials? I thought that diplomacy was supposed to be a patrician world where everyone respected each other's privacy and drank white wine.
They appear to do that, but they also appear to do other things as well. And very often that includes essentially putting together profiles of the various people that they negotiate and deal with on a day-to-day basis. And that includes insights into how they conduct their private lives as well as how they conduct their business and political lives. And it runs all around the world. In a lot of ways, it's almost like the kind of material that if one ambassador was to provide for say a visiting Secretary of State or other ambassador, there's the material there so that they can prepare and know who they're dealing with.
Know who they're dealing with, but also use leverage against them in a negotiation. I mean, is this everything from the types of food they like to maybe their proclivities that could be used against them? Let's say if they were doing something clandestine.
Culinary habits, I haven't seen that much of. Proclivities, sure. And to use against them. I don't know if it's so much that as trying to prepare for the tough diplomatic battles that they see ahead and what they're trying to accomplish.
But Andy Laron, you also report that there's collection of credit card information, frequent flyer information. What does that say about what U.S. diplomatic officials are being asked to compile about their counterparts?
That's one of the curious requests that we see going out. What remains uncertain is how much of that information is actually gathered. But clearly, the diplomats do gather information or ask to gather information. That's almost like a complete background check. And how that information is used is something. That I guess we'll have to wait to see.
All right. Well, it's time to turn to the real world now, and we have a real ambassador, Ronald Newman. Ambassador, you've been in Afghanistan and Algeria and Bahrain. What do you make of this stuff? Just potentially embarrassing information between diplomats, or is this a serious breach?
This is really hurtful. I don't think it serves any useful national purpose. I was looking at some of it last night. I saw a country that has been willing to send some troops to one of the wars we're in, but they wanted to do it quietly. Now, we publicize that, so somebody else that might have sent some troops to relieve American soldiers probably won't do it. You know, a lot of this stuff is damaging in the sense of what it does to people's willingness to talk to you, frankly. I can imagine a man telling his wife something about his mother-in-law, which would be pretty damaging to the marriage if his wife repeated it to her mother. And then you've got to get on with the mother in the marriage. That's the kind of damage you're doing. It's hard to quantify. I think this intelligence cable, by the way, is the least and silliest piece of this discussion. That's a very routine, low-level cable that goes out once a year, and everybody in the entire intelligence community dumps their wish list into it. I think you've seized on trivia there.
Well, what does it mean for diplomatic relations? What does it mean for our diplomats, your former colleagues in the diplomatic corps, to be asked to essentially be asked to spy? Does it change their job description in a way that's counterproductive in your view?
No, you got hold of this one, I think, by the wrong end.
Okay.
Once a year, the entire intelligence community, including people who do research in state, put out a requirements cable, everything they'd like to know. And as people pick up some of it, they will report it. But it doesn't that the entire diplomatic operation turns on its head and runs around after that cable. And the fact that it's signed Clinton is irrelevant because every single cable that goes out of the State Department bears the name of the Secretary of State of the day. It doesn't mean it's approved by her personally. It's approved way down in the bowels of the bureaucracy.
All right, so a little bit of the window into this bureaucratic nature, even to the State Department. Andy Laren from the New York Times, let me turn back to you because the New York Times chose to publish a lot of information from these cables. It chose to hold some of it back. Some of it's redacted, and the Times cooperated with the State Department and with the White House not to release certain information and certain sources. What went into the thinking there in terms of what to publish and what not to publish?
Sure. Well, first off, just so you know, I was not in the conversations with the White House. That was some of my colleagues, and we've had many colleagues working on these series of stories. But what we were trying to balance was what we saw as part of an independent press. That's important for readers in dealing with national and international affairs. What's important information for them to get hold of. At the same time, balancing pressing material that would obviously affect national security.
And the New York Times. The Times and other papers make these judgments all the time when they decide what to hold back. They exercise editorial judgment. My question is, ultimately, in this instance, does it matter if WikiLeaks is going to follow through on its promise and post all 250,000 of these documents on the internet anyway? Does the New York Times editorial judgment really make a difference in this case?
Well, what WikiLeaks does is what WikiLeaks does. We're trying to do what we believe is best and most appropriate.
And the stuff that you've held back may ultimately come out anyway.
It may not. Don't forget there are other news organizations reporting about this as well, and they are also independent news organizations.
And this story is going to continue to be written because 250,000 documents are either out or on the way out, and we've only just gotten our very first look at them. And that first look largely came in the pages of the New York Times, our partner, written in part by Andy Laren, who has just joined us. And we were also joined by Ronald E. Newman, former ambassador to Afghanistan, Algeria, and Bahrain. Thank you both.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.